Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for staying to the end of the day. I was thinking I was going to come to an empty room, so I'm glad there's some people here. I will make sure that you guys, it's worth it for your time to spend the next hour and help you understand a little bit about what's going to come down the road for the next 10 years with the combination of AI and XR. I think these are truly transformational technologies that will have significant long-term impact. Right? So, this talk is actually based on a book that just came out last week. This book called Our Next Reality, and it's a joint work between myself and Louis Rosenberg. We've both been in the industry for 33 years, both in the AI and the XR space, and so I think we're actually speaking from experience, and we're going to talk about the practicalities of things, not just theory. And what we also want to do is to really help bring more clarity, right? Because with this, with all the hype that's going on, there's a lot of misunderstandings. So, I can't get into all the details in this time. I'm going to probably do about a half hour talk and then a half hour of Q&A. And then at the end, if anybody's interested, I'll sign some book cards for people who actually want to make a purchase and, you know, want to have more details. So, the foreword was actually written by Neil Stephenson, who coined the word metaverse. So our subtitle is How the AI-Powered Metaverse Will Reshape the World. And I know metaverse is a bad word these days. You know, a lot of people are poo-pooing it. But the point of the book is actually not about the word metaverse. It's really about the concept of what the metaverse stands for. And it's essentially how a 3D-based internet is going to come, and how that together interacts with AI. Right? So, by the end of this hour, you will hopefully understand what I mean by metaverse, and it's not, you know, crypto and the NFTs. So, with trying to understand, what we did was Louis and I thought about what are some really pressing questions that the world has today about, you know, this topic, and we essentially did a debate model, right? Because most books, what you'll find is that there's either very super hype books or super doomer books, and the reality is never extremes. So we've essentially taken a position of, okay, I'm going to play the optimist, and Louis will play the more conservative pessimist person. And that way, we give both sides of the story so that the reader can come to their own conclusions in terms of where they think the technology is going and where the results and impact of this technology will be. And in terms of the topics, we've essentially tackled 13 of the key questions that we think people are interested in. And, you know, I'm not going to go through each of them, but essentially initially more on technology side, and then the middle part is really more about the in various industries and the impact of that. And the last third is really about the societal impact, from economics to geopolitics to how do we actually realize the positive future that we're looking for. And at the end of the day, most people think it's, you know, all of this stuff is Black Mirror, all of this is going to be a dystopian future. And I really want people to kind of break the mold a little bit, right? And a Black Mirror essentially is a phone or a computer turned off, it's a black screen. We want to move into a 3D space. I think that's the thing that I think is different about what the metaverse or immersive technology provides that isn't there before. And every technology we all, you know, talk about it being a, you know, two-edged sword, a double-edged sword, where it can be good or it can be bad. But the reality, actually, of most technologies is that it's neither completely good or completely bad. It's much more like a yin-yang symbol. Even in the best of best, you have some darkness. And in the worst of worst, you have some brightness, right? So whatever happens in the next 10, 20 years with these technologies, it will have a component of both. And it's really up to us what we do in terms of nudging it towards the more brighter or the more darker future. And the beauty is that actually all of us right now have an enormous power and responsibility, because what we do for the next 5 years could, or maybe 5 to 10 years, could impact the future of humanity for thousands of years. Right? So when we talk about metaverse, everybody thinks about Snow Crash and, you know, Ready Player One, Matrix, and it's always very dark and very dystopian. But it doesn't have to be. And a lot of people are thinking, oh, you know, this hype is over. But what I want to actually emphasize with you is it, not only is it not dead, this metaverse concept is not dead, it's actually an inevitable concept. Why is that? Because if the metaverse is talking about and represents a 3D internet, we as humans have evolved over millions of years to be in a 3D world. We are optimized to perform and live and interact in a 3D world. And that's what this represents. So no matter what, it's just a matter of time, us moving from a screen that's on our desk or on our walls or in our pockets to something that's on our face. And so in terms of what is a clear definition of the metaverse, I want to, you know, I'm more from the kind of technical or engineering background, so I gave you a quick formula that it was easy to understand, at least because most definitions you see out there are, you know, half a page long, and it includes a lot of terms that it just confuses people. So the easy way to think about it is metaverse is a 3D version of the internet powered by AI and mostly interfaced by immersive technologies. And when I say immersive technologies, I'm talking about these devices, these VR, AR devices, right? I know, you know, recently we had the Apple Vision Pro that released, and you know that thing is about 600 grams. We already released these devices a year ago. That's 200 grams. That does most of the functionality of what that is. In another couple of years, we will get to devices that are more like what I'm wearing in terms of glasses that will do most of the functionality of what the Vision Pro or this Vive XR Elite will do. Oops. So I know that these still aren't perfect, but we have come a long ways. When I started getting into this industry 33 years ago, the devices I had was 2.5 kilograms. Right? This one is 200 grams. So it's less than 1/10 the size of what it used to be. And it was hundreds of thousands of dollars for the workstation, the Silicon Graphics workstation, plus this VPL headset for it to operate. And it was about 1/100th the resolution. So if you look at how things have progressed over time, we are getting to a point where it is actually good enough, right? And hardware is not really the issue. And so I mentioned Neil Stephenson, that he actually came to the launch of this product a year ago, and I kind of ran this definition by him. I said, because since he coined the word, I figured he would know. And he said, hey, you know, when I wrote Snow Crash, I kind of just made stuff up. But what you're describing and the way you describe it, it makes sense to me. So if it's good enough for Neil, I figure it's good enough for me. Now, one other thing I want to kind of emphasize, why do I think 3D is really the way to go, or is the direction, an inevitable direction, is if you look at over history, the last 100 years or so, or actually several hundred years, as media changes, the content changes, and it keeps adding more and more dimensions, more and more fidelity, and more interaction, right? From going from paper to radio to TV to interactive gaming, you're essentially adding more dimensions and more interactivity and more movement. Now that we are at these 3D immersive devices, we get to the next step, which is natural interface, immersive, and 3D. So it's just a natural progression. It is not something that people just made up. It's actually, you can see the very clear trend. Now, when I say natural interface, I don't mean keyboards and mouse and touch screen. I mean, that's what we've been taught over the last few decades to use, but they are actually not very natural. I try to get my mom to type, and she still cannot type, and you know, she still gets in trouble even with an iPad, which a lot of people think are very, you know, simple devices. What we need to do is to start using our hands, our voice, you know, in fact, even our minds as a way to interface. And all of that is actually available today. Some of it, you know, needs to get simpler, cheaper, you know, more intuitive. But, you know, you look at the Vision Pro, it doesn't even come with controllers, right? So they are, you know, enabling a system that works innately with voice, with eyes, and with your hands, you know, just touching your hands. That's where things are going. And when that happens, essentially, people of any age and of you know, any level of education can use these devices and interact in these virtual worlds, right? So we really don't have the boundaries that we do today with technology. In terms of screens, It's hard to imagine that 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, we had zero screens. 120 years ago, we had no screens in our lives. It was actually only in 1895 that the first screen became in our lives, right? And it was the biggest screen, the silver screen. But over, every few decades, we would add a few more screens. And if you look at this trend, you think, by the end of this decade, we'll have two or three more screens. And the reality is actually completely backwards. We will be gradually replacing every single screen that we have on our walls and in our pockets and our desk with something that's on our face, right? And in the long, long term, we may actually get back to the original experience, which is no screens, because some will have some type of brain computer interface device, probably not the one made by Elon yet. I think we're going to get to that consolidation, right? So if you look at the devices that we have today, they're already a lot smaller than people think. And in fact, there are already devices that are coming out this year that are this type of form factor of what I have, fairly normal size glasses that has a display in it, right? We had the Google Glass, 10, 12 years ago, and that had a lot of issues. It was a little too early for its time. But I think with the advancements that's happened over the last decade, we will very quickly see devices that are all day wear display glasses form factor, right? And it may take a little bit of time for that price to come down to average consumer level, but it will happen as we have seen on all other electronic devices in the past. Now we talk a little bit about AI, right? Artificial intelligence has been in everybody's piece of probably speech this week and the last year and all the stories online, and again. There's this fear of, okay, the robots are coming, they're going to destroy us all, but they're just, aimless, parrots, stochastic parrots, right? What I want to say is actually not only are they not stochastic parrots, and they will actually become more and more sophisticated over time, and I think we will actually get to this AGI, artificial general intelligence, a lot faster than people think. And I'll show you some data to kind of give you a sense of what I mean. So why? What is the relationship between AI and XR? Right? XR being AR, VR, MR. The reality is that every single component of what makes metaverse and immersive technologies capable today all rely on having some level of artificial intelligence. The fact that you need it for hand control, voice control, translation, scanning the room, having controllers, all of that, right? And very soon the avatars or the NPCs inside these virtual worlds are all going to be powered by AI. And today we are already seeing you have text prompts to create virtual worlds or 3D objects, right? All of that is going to continue to make sure that all the issues that we have so far of why XR has not taken off as much as it could have, or a lot of people expected it to, will actually get solved and will become increasingly more realistic and more natural. So when we talk about AI, a lot of people just say, generative AI, it's all about ChatGPT. That's, the last year and a half, that's been the hot topic, and that's what's brought this to the forefront for people because it made AI accessible. But the reality is that AI has been around as long as XR. They're both about 60 plus years old. In fact, my advisor in school, they call him the godfather of VR, and he's been doing it for almost 60 years. He started in the Air Force developing these super cockpit helmets that was doing VR and AR devices on $1 million headsets, right? So both of these have developed, and they have both matured around the same time, which is making it super amazing that we are at this time, because this is a very special time, I think, in the history of media and in the history of humanity. We will soon not only be able to create text output and chat, but also we're already creating AI-driven music, AI-created pictures, AI-created videos. I'm sure a couple weeks ago you guys saw the Sora picture, the videos of the OpenAI Sora, which you can put a prompt and it would make a minute-long video that look photorealistic. We are now also seeing worlds that are being created in 3D with an AI prompt. In fact, yesterday I was just at the immersive experiences at Fairmont. And one of the demos there was, it actually really amazed me, because things that I've been talking about for the last couple of years is actually really starting to become real. It asked me 10 questions about my background, what my interests are, you know, what were some of my exciting moments in life. And then after it was done with the questions, in real time, it created a story based on my life, based on my interests in the 3D world, and I watched it in one of my own company's headsets. Right. That future is already here. It's not something that is imagined or will come a few years from now. And you know, the quality of it is still kind of, you know, it could be improved. But just like we've seen how the photo creation have advanced over the last year, from you know really just things that look very like what we described to now completely photorealistic, and even experts cannot tell the difference. Very soon we will be able to create virtual worlds where experts cannot tell the difference. And you know, thinking about how amazing that these devices are today, or these AI systems are today, it's kind of interesting to think most of them were trained just on words, just on text. So it's kind of like if you had a child and your child was deaf and blind and couldn't move, and you just fed it words, and it's able to, you know, write poetry and calculate, you know, formulas and you know, summarize a book and do philosophy from just that amount of information. What we will soon have is actually a multimodal model where it starts having video and sensors information and sound and music and video and you know, 3D environments. It's going to be so much more capable because it is going to be so much more informed about what happens in the world. And now, you do hear people say, oh, you know, we're running out of data, you know, and once we run out of data, this stuff is not going to work. The reality is actually there's 180 zettabytes of just text data, right? So what's a zettabyte? Zettabyte is a billion terabytes. So all those hard drives that you have at home, they're about 1 to 4 terabytes. So 180 billion of those right now in terms of text-only data. And that's and when you train any of the current LLM systems, they're putting in a few terabytes, when we're talking about 180 billion terabytes that's available, right? So I don't think we're running out of text anytime soon. The other thing is that does not even include multimodal data, videos, music, you know, web pages, all these, you know, 3D information. And then you get all the sensor data, all the cameras out there, the DNA data, weather data, satellite data, right? Then you add in synthetic data. And synthetic data is essentially AI systems creating data to then train other AIs. I know I hear people say, oh, but then you know it's just going to corrupt because when AI makes mistakes, it's just going to perpetuate and it's going to be worse and worse. The reality is what we're seeing is the high-end models are actually now summarizing the information and creating much higher performance, much more efficient, smaller models at a fraction, maybe a tenth or a hundredth the size, that performs at maybe 90 to 95% as good as the, you know, trillion parameter models. They can do it in 10 billion parameters or 5 billion parameters. So synthetic data actually may be a very good thing for data, not a bad thing. So I think we're probably safe. And so data may actually not be the oil that everybody thinks it is. So just kind of a little bit, I think, a little bit of misunderstanding out there. Now, what is important is not just having amount of data, is having a good distribution of data. So I could give it, you know, 100 zettabytes of information, but if it's all one-sided biased information, you will have a one-sided biased AI. What we need to do is actually to take the world's data, gather it, and make it all available to this AI and let it learn based on the complete breadth of information out there. That's the only way we can avoid the biases that we are innately putting in there. And so we will, you know, instead of having a blind child, we will have this very, very creative child that will be completely informed on everything that we've ever done and ever recorded. Now, a lot of people are scared to say, hey, or you know, they'll say, what about these AIs? They're going to be sentient. They're going to come and destroy us, right? And then, you know, are they going to be conscious? Is it possible or not? So I guess first I wanted to kind of mention that consciousness is not a point. A lot of people think, oh, consciousness is just human level consciousness. The reality is it's actually, it's a spectrum. Everything from just pure sentience, being able to understand your environments and react to the environment, to sapient, which is what we are, which is ability to analyze and have logic, to some type of a transcendence in terms of, you know, really having full knowledge of the world, right? And even things like bacteria and ants have sentience. Even, you know, chimps have sapience. They understand, they can see themselves. You know, we hear about Nago inside. What does it feel like to be something? And what does it feel like to be a bat? So there are different levels of consciousness. Now, you know, the traditional AI, the good old-fashioned AI, are not conscious. They're just a procedure. We just say, you know, when you see this, you know, when you see A, do B. When you see B, do C, right? There is no consciousness. It's just procedure. But what we see now with these large language models, these frontier models, it's actually somewhere in between. You know, I don't know if it's ant level or bat level or bacteria level, but it is not completely, you know, unconscious. There, you know, with all the people that are testing it, for it to do the things that it does, it has to have some understanding of the world. Now, the other thing that a lot of people talk about is AGI, and, you know, AGI is actually human-level intelligence, but it does not require human-level consciousness. What we need to get to is more strong AI, which is, you know, human or beyond-level consciousness, human or beyond-level intelligence. And it may still be strong, but it probably is not as strong as humanity put together, right? What will come over time, and actually it may come faster than most people believe or think, is ASI, artificial superintelligence, which will be not just tens of times smarter than us, it will be millions of times smarter than the smartest human. Right? It will be more intelligent than the combined intelligence of all humans. And so it will help, you know, hopefully bring us along with it, make us smarter by having its skills transferred to us through our machines, through our tools. Right? The most scary part is not the ASI. It's not this all-knowing, transcendent, compassionate, you know, rational AI. The most scary part is actually the middle part. When we have these premature AGIs that is very powerful, but does not understand right or wrong, does not, you know who they should listen to, and if it's being guided by a bad actor human, that's the most dangerous part. And that's where we are close to right now. We are at that LLM, FM level, and we are very close to getting to AGI. You know, depending on who you believe in, it's the next 2 years to the next 10 to 20 years. In either case, it is within our lifetime, we will get to some type of an AGI, according to most experts in the space. Right? Now, one of the requirements to get to AGI is something, you know, essentially people say, once AI programs can program other AIs, then we're going to be pretty close to getting AGI, because they will be able to move and program and improve at paces that humans can't, right? Even the best programmers are, you know, working at probably 8 hours of productive work. Most humans are probably working at 2 hours of productive work a day. These things are working at 24 hours of productive work a day at a million times the speed that we can. Right, so think about how quickly that happens. And if there was experts that, you know, 1,000 plus experts in the space were asked with this site called Metaculus, and they said, oh, you know, a few years ago, just actually, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, it was at 2050 or so, people said that would happen. Just a few months ago, they said 2026. So that's, you know, 2 years from now. So yesterday, or maybe the day before, actually, I think it was yesterday, they would just announce something called Devin by a company called Cognition, who just raised a couple $100 million, and it created what they said was the first AI-based programmer that can program AI. So that was yesterday. So even these optimistic optimistic forecasts were saying 2 years away, it's already starting to happen. Now, that's probably a very premature version of it, so it won't, you know, it won't be making perfect programs, but to see that it's already starting to happen, I think it's a very important sign. A few years ago, just, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, people were saying 2080, 2090 before we get to AGI, right? Just this last year, a few months ago, it's saying 2030. So we've come down from 2080 to 2030 within the last few years from what experts are saying of when AGI will happen. Right? And whether or not AI will have consciousness, right now 60%+ of researchers and AI experts think it will. So The things that I said earlier, a lot of people were like, oh, I don't really believe it. You know, but this is not me saying it. This is what thousands of people in this industry who know the technology are saying. And what happens when we get AGI, right? What happens is that we essentially help to increase our understanding, our intelligence, orders of magnitude, right? And having the understanding means that we now have much higher productivity than we've ever had, right? Every single technology we've invented increased our productivity, from fire to the wheels to machines to electronics. We continually increase our productivity, not by 1 or 2x, but by thousands of x. In fact, I think from the early agricultural to now, it's something around a 10,000x of productivity increase per human. Right. So with this, if you have, you know, a million times increase in our intelligence, what do we get to? And we'll probably soon get to solving some of the major issues, like how do we get free energy? How do we solve the climate issue, right? All this carbon sequestration only works if you can have free energy, because right now it's actually negative energy you're burning coal to then create electricity to then sequester carbon. It doesn't work. That formula does not work. Right. So we need to be able to create essentially fusion or some kind of more efficient way of creating clean energy. We'll probably solve the health issues. You know, all these health problems that have plagued us for thousands of years will be solved. Right. We'll probably make aging less of an issue. I'm not saying we're going to live forever, but I think, you know, getting to 120 years on a healthy way is probably possible, at least to most of the experts in the space. There's no innate reason, biological reason why we couldn't do it. So what this brings is an age of abundance, where we will, as a society, as a world, have essentially everything that we would need to have a fulfilled life. You know, and then we talk about things like interstellar travel and all the sci-fi stuff. I won't go into that, right? So, but what this promise is actually pretty amazing. Now, that's the positive side. Now, then you have the other side who says, you know, the robots are coming, it's going to kill us, we need to go and destroy the data centers before AI escapes, right? And what I would say to you is, don't panic, not yet anyways. And, you know, I've seen multiple ups and downs of these cycles, and you don't need to get as excited. In fact, one of the reasons I'm not that excited or that worried is because in the process of writing this book, I actually read the biographies of the top 10 best leaders in our, you know, last 100 years, and the top 10 worst or most authoritative leaders. And the one thing that really stood out of what made somebody a good leader and a bad leader was the amount of education they had and the amount of lifelong learning they had, right? So people like Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot, they all stopped learning early. They didn't have a habit of continuing to learn beyond their normal scope. People like Mandela and Gandhi and Lee Kuan Yew, most of them went in grad school and they read books voraciously. And the more you know, the more you actually appreciate other people's perspectives and the less you want to use violence as your way to control and maintain power. In fact, I also looked at these, you know, 10 versus 10 leaders, and I thought, oh, maybe some of them because they have military background, because all of the authoritative leaders had military background. But 60% of the most admired leaders also had military background, but they didn't use it because they didn't need to. Right? And I think this is promising because we will be creating an AI that will be the most informed, you know, being that has ever existed, and we'll be able to understand everybody's perspectives from their own perspective, right? And I think that helps us solve some of the basic issues. Now, what are the risks that people talk about today? So one is the AI takeover. Actually, because of what I just said, I'm actually less concerned about that. And then there's actually been research that came out in the last couple of years that have shown that intelligent, more complete, higher trained AI systems had a higher sense of compassion in terms of their responses to questions. Right? Now, there's also something called the alignment problem. Is, you know, how do we make sure we align it to human values? How do we make sure that we're important to them when we get when we create these AI systems? How do we know that it's not going to make a bunch of paperclips and use up all the resources in the world? I'm actually less worried about, particularly the paperclip problem, because if something is smart enough to know how to make an unlimited amount of paperclips by creating unlimited energy, and then to transform that energy to create everything into paperclips, they're probably smart enough to figure out that that's probably not a good thing to kill the world by making paperclips, right? And the other thing is, do we really want to align AI to our values today? If we think about what our values were 50 years ago when there was no animal rights, 100 years ago when there was no human rights for certain classes of people, you know, a couple hundred years ago when there was very little rights for females and for children, you know, they could be sold at just like anything, right? Our values continue to change as we develop, as we mature as a society. So locking that value to what we have today is probably not necessarily the right thing to do yet, right? The thing I am worried about is the job displacement issue and is the societal instability issue. When you start having 30, 40, 50, 60% of our population lose their job, lose their form of income, lose a purpose in terms of where they identify as their core value, it's going to create issues. People are going to be on the street with nothing to do. That is not a good thing. Even if we had UBI, even if we had their housing and their food covered and they had no purpose, we will be in trouble as a society. So how do we solve that? I'll talk a little bit about that. And the thing that is even probably more pressing and more immediate is the last issue, which is misuse, misinformation, and manipulation, where this technology is in the hands of bad actors, and they will use this technology to then create value for themselves, but then take away value from society. And I spent 3 years working for a cybersecurity company in the past, and I can tell you that whenever new technologies come out, the first people to use it are these bad actors, because there is still an opportunity for very, very quick returns when there's no protection or no defense against these systems. Right? So it will be an issue. And you know, with our coming elections, manipulation will also be an issue. You know, if advertising was a core source of revenue, are manipulating us to buy things, you know, essentially the whole capitalistic economic model will be an issue. We're already seeing this today with just social networks. Think about a social network that's on your face and knows everything about you, knows how you feel about what you're looking at, how much it can influence you. Now, even OpenAI, who's trying to make themselves look good, is telling people that, hey, you know, there's a job issue. It's already, the version that came out almost a year ago is already able to do 80 or 90% as, you know, better than 80 or 90% of humans in terms of most tasks, everything from being a lawyer to being an accountant to being a mathematician, et cetera, right? And the difference this time with the job displacement impact is that it is actually more impactful to the higher income bracket. So the higher your income, the higher your potential negative impact in terms of being displaced, right? Whereas in the past, you know, when we had machines and robots, it was really the lower end manual workers that were more replaced. And according to their study, essentially the ones that are the most in danger are, you know, programmers and scientists and mathematicians and tax preparers and accountants. And the ones that are safest are the dishwashers and the carpenters and the plumbers, right? Maybe not everybody wants to be a carpenter or plumber, but at least, you know, those may be the safest jobs for a short term. And I still say actually for a short term. Why do I say that? Because there's already humanoid robots are being created by, you know, major companies. The left one is actually sponsored by OpenAI, and the right one is sponsored by Tesla, both very large companies with a lot of resources, right? And they are intended to be able to do all the manual work as well. So the mental labor will definitely be the first to be replaced, but the manual labor is not safe for very long. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? Let's think about this a little bit. So over the last, you know, a couple hundred years, we've seen that as productivity increases, the average hours work of labor per country continue to reduce. So productivity is actually showing clear trend of reducing the amount of hours that we are spending, in a factory or in an office. Right? And even today, we actually go back to medieval and hunter-gatherer days. The archaeologists and scientists estimate that it's somewhere around 1,000 to 1,200 hours. So actually, humans, before we had all this technology, we were working about 1,200 hours to 1,000 hours a year. We're now working 2,000 to 3,000 hours a year. So all of the industrialization actually increased our hours. But I mean, part of it is also that we now have light. Before, we had to work with the sun up and down and so forth. But we're actually working more now than we did when we had no technology. But if we now take a trend of just even today, we're not over hundreds of years, but even today, or at least 2019 data, depending on the income level of the country, the productivity level of the country, there is a clear trend of hours worked as a direct proportion to the productivity of the country or the income of that country, right? So if we take that extended, essentially once we get that 10x, 100x increase in productivity, all of our labor will go towards zero in terms of hours worked, right? I'm not saying now everybody's gonna be out of a job, but what this means is you will have a choice of whether or not you want to work. Just because everything can be fulfilled by you doesn't mean you don't have to work. I mean, well, it means you don't have to, but it means that if you want to, you could. If you want to be a kick-ass programmer, keep doing it. If you want to be a kick-ass architect, keep doing it, right? If it makes you happy, keep doing it. If you want to be a researcher, go do it. If you want to be a musician, go do it. I think that's the freedom it gives us. So having no work, 0 hours, is actually a good thing, because the freedom of having the choice of how you spend your time is actually one of the highest correlations to happiness. Okay. This now is, what will you do? So this is where I think AI and XR come together, where the concept of the metaverse comes together, because the metaverse creates an unlimited world for you to imagine whatever you want to be. Essentially, everybody can be an artist. Right. Everybody can go and imagine new forms of creation. They can create virtual businesses. They can create virtual statues, virtual worlds, and invite their friends over. Of course, they can also be entertained. They can go back in history. They can create immersive games, adventures that they can go on. And I think these are the kind of things that will give a new purpose to that next generation, because now we have a way to earn income on a virtual world that is not limited by our surroundings, right? Most people want to come to places like the US because higher income, more job opportunities, better education, etc. But if you start moving a lot of this infrastructure into a virtual world, anybody with a glasses, with a headset, can have access to the same level of education, the same job market, the same asset of the knowledge of the world. And I think that the same education system, I think that changes the entire equation of between the kind of haves and have-nots and the inequality that's built up over the last several hundred years. So what are the things we need to do? First, we need to educate the public to make sure that they understand the risks and benefits of what AI will represent, right? This is actually the main reason that my co-author and I wrote this book, because we want to help people understand the issues that are here. We need to have international regulatory cooperation. Right now, it's every country, every region is having their own, and it doesn't help. You actually need to do things together. In fact, we need to have the international regulation, we need to have international cooperation in terms of developing these resources. Think about what's happening today, is that every single country, every single research lab is in a race to be the first to create AGI. And AGI is going to be a very, very tempting, you could say, a weapon for them or a tool for them to gain advantage in the world. And whoever gets it first will be highly tempted to utilize it. So essentially, if any country wins, any company wins, the human race will lose, right? Because they will set us off onto a very slippery slope where then we just start using this as a weapon against each other. We also need to create countermeasures for detecting the misuse of AI. Right now, I hear a lot of people talk about AI alignment and safety, but very few people talking about, how do I detect that there's an AI there? How do I detect that I'm being manipulated by a message? How do I detect that this content is actually not an authentic content? How do I detect that I'm being brainwashed by something that somebody wants to use? Right? Those kind of things. Or how do we make sure that somebody's not embedding bad code into something that was making a drug that then now has a side effect that we didn't know about? Right? We also need to retrain a large portion of our workforce. We need to make sure that it's UBI so that people have their basic needs supported, right? So that they actually have a new purpose. We need to create that open metaverse system so that everybody in the world has an ability to access this new ecosystem, this new economy that is going to be a digital economy that connects us across borders. And lastly, we need to pool our resources to make sure we come to a alignment or a development of this AGI. Right? Right now, everybody says, "Oh, we're limited by compute." But we're limited by compute because every single company in every single country is trying to make the same thing and duplicating efforts. That's why we're limited by compute. If we pull everybody's GPUs into a pool and everybody shares the results of that, it's actually, we probably have a lot more compute than we think. So one of the things that the metaverse or immersive worlds can do is actually create a way for us to come to that alignment, right? Everybody hears the understand or read probably or watched the movie Matrix, where you know you have humans being put into virtual worlds. What we can also do to align this AI is actually to put the AI into virtual worlds, so that you put an AI in a simulation and then make it think that it's in the real world and see what it does. Right? Is it going to come out and try to rule the world? Is it going to come out and try to help people? And so by having the ability to test out multiple versions of these AGI and see where that simulation goes, it gives us a sense of which algorithm, which type of alignment tactics actually would be effective. Right? That nobody thinks that we cannot align, but everybody thinks that if we only have one chance to align, then we're probably in trouble. Right? All the people who are saying we're doomed, their biggest fear is that you know we have to get it right the first time, and it's going to be you know get it right in terms of being able to control something that is a million times smarter than you. That's pretty hard to do it the first time. But if we had a simulation, we actually probably could. I'm going to skip some of these things. So this is more about the need for international cooperation to try to solve these issues. I'll just spend one moment on this. So if you look at who remembers this movie? Arrival. So when they started, they had a lot of cooperation between countries. At the end, they all stopped talking to each other, and then that was kind of part of the problem, right? When you start to disconnect and not help each other, you limit your resources. When they, you know, were actually trying to cooperate, it actually can help. So we need to kind of avoid this problem today of everybody in a race condition for themselves. And if we do, I think we can bring a very positive future. We can bring, you know, a super intelligent teacher to every child on Earth. Right? I mean, you say these devices, they're, $1,000, they're too expensive. The average phone, high-end phone today is $1,000. In fact, if you go to even emerging markets, there are $50 phones out there. Right? And they do all the same things, almost all the same things as the high-end phones. It will be the same for immersive technologies. We will be able to get to a few hundred dollars, $100 immersive devices everywhere in the world. Right? And the average, in the developing markets, the average budgets the governments had for education is somewhere between $10,000 to $15,000. There's actually enough money to make sure we pay for these things if we wanted to. Right? A lot of people say, but then, all this immersive stuff is going to make you fat. It's going to make you like Wall-E. If you look, they're not actually wearing headsets. They're actually looking at a 2D screen. They're sitting down looking at a 2D screen, right? What they need to do is actually, if they were, in a headset, they're standing around, they're moving. I actually did a research with the Sports University of Beijing, and we found that when people are doing long duration use, their heart rate is actually just like a light stroll. Their elevated heart rate, elevated activities when they're using VR for long sessions, much more healthy than when you're sitting around in front of a keyboard and a screen. Right? The other problem that we will have is probably this. Can you turn the sound on? So maybe some of you remember this scene from Ready Player One, where the villain comes and says, we're gonna take over our people's screens and we're gonna be able to maximize optimize our profits.
We can sell up to 80% of an individual's visual field before inducing seizures.
Yeah. So if we leave it to the social networks today, that probably will be what happens. So we need to start moving away from a marketing-driven immersive model. Right? Immersive technologies are going to be more effective in terms of inducing action. And I've done multiple studies. There's a lot of data in the book that talks about this. Right? So in terms of economic models, over the last few thousand years, you can see that we've actually gone through multiple phases, from hunter-gatherer to pastoral to agricultural, commercial, industrial revolutions, and then now digital, right? And very soon we're going to get into this AI and spatial age. And at each age, our productivity is increasing, not by, you know, this linear graph. This is more of an exponential graph. And actually, if you look at hunter-gatherer versus where we are today, it's around 10 to 12,000 X in terms of productivity. And at each phase, a particular resource is the most limited thing, from initially time to livestock, to labor, to transport, to machines, you know, power, automation, software and data, to now we actually go back to what we originally had, which is time. Because once you have infinite productivity or much higher productivity, the other things don't matter anymore. The only thing that we're limited to is our time. And at each level, each phase, we've had different types of governance models, from initially egalitarian to feudalism to capitalism to socialism. And, you know, what's coming next? Actually, a lot of people think that, you know, capitalism has been around for a long, long time. And it's actually, it's only been around for, you know, 200-300 years. Not that long, if you look back in terms of how long people have been around. So having an egalitarian model where you share everything is actually a lot more natural than what we have today, of having a super rich and then everybody else being a labor class. Right? So where we can get to probably is going to back to where we were more egalitarian. In fact, if you look at even some of the hunter-gatherers that are still around today, the chiefs and everybody else eat the same thing. They live in the same huts. They do the same work. Right? I think we will be getting somewhere close to that type of a model. Now, we also did a look in terms of the political comparisons of different types of governance over, you know, the last few thousand years. And, you know, here's the current ones that are available. And then in the past, we've had, you know, anarchy and feudalism and state communism and imperialism. And what we find is that the larger the scope of the territory being governed, the more centralized, actually, the governing power, right? And, you know, right now there are some more distributed things like DAOs and intergovernment organizations, things like UN or OPEC or whatever, but they're more loosely coupled, not really a true management model. If you look at what we want to get to, the optimal model based on, you know, all the philosophers out there is actually a philosopher king. Something where it's very centralized, but it's very benevolent and it's very objective, right? When you have a human, it's very difficult to do. But when you start having an AI and you have this AI oracle that can understand all the data out there, know everybody's needs and be able to balance their needs, I think that's the long-term future. Now, it's going to take some time for us to get to where we are today, where every country has their own government, everybody has their own initiatives. But longer term, if you look at the trend of where this is going, it actually will probably head towards a more centralized, more data-driven, rational model of management. And if we start going beyond our planet, we definitely need more help. Right? You probably know this scene from 2001, Space Odyssey, and it actually goes through kind of our multiple million years of evolution. And if you look, actually, the first few million years, we had a lot of evolution, right? But the last 100,000 years, the human has not changed. We, as a being, as an organism, haven't gotten smarter, taller, bigger brain or anything. In fact, our brain is about 10% smaller than we were about 100,000 years ago. But we have used tools and technology to enhance what we can do. And over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we will continue to add additional technologies to enhance our capabilities and enhance our intelligence. And at each phase, we will change our priorities of what our focus is. In the past, it was just about survival, and then it got to tribal dominance. Now we're probably at national dominance. We're competing to see which country is best. And then I think we're going to get to preserving our species. Once we have all the things that we need, we just want to make sure we keep going. The average mammal lives about 2 million years. We've been around for, you know, a couple hundred thousand years. So if we were the average, we actually still have a long ways to go. we're not the average. Actually, the biggest risks right now are all human-created risks, anthropomorphic risk, right, in terms of existential risk. We will continue to expand, hopefully, making once we get to that level of abundance, we will be able to expand our horizons and expand our scope to think more about how do we preserve and consciousness and expand consciousness, how do we preserve intelligence and expand it beyond our planet. And that's kind of the long-term future versus trying to compete in terms of which country is stronger, who has the most weapons, or who has the most money. Most of those things won't matter anymore in this future.
However, the most intelligent inhabitants of that future world
You may recognize this gentleman, Arthur C. Clarke.
Or monkeys.
He said this in 1964.
The remote descendants of today's computers.
So 60 years
now, the present-day electronic brains are complete morons, but this will not be true in another generation. They will start to think, and eventually they will completely outthink their makers. Is this depressing? I don't see why it should be. We superseded the Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal men, and we presume we're an improvement. I think we should regard it as a privilege to be stepping stones to higher things. I suspect that organic or biological evolution has about come to its end, and we are now at the beginning of inorganic or mechanical evolution, which will...
Okay, so he goes on for 4 or 5 minutes, but what I want to get people to think about is we shouldn't look at AI as something that is a threat to us. We should look at AI as our next generation, as our descendants. Just like if your child got a better job than you did, made more money than you did, was more successful than you are, you'd be pretty proud of them. We are at a phase where we are actually creating the next generation, our children, that may be a different form of life. Right? Now, it may not be as fully conscious, or its consciousness may not be the same as us, but it will have a certain level of intelligence, and it will have a certain level of autonomy. So if we think of it not as, you know, something that will come and take us over, but versus something that can help bring the resources that we need to have a more abundant and peaceful life, it's actually a beautiful thing. Right? In the Eastern culture, the children spend a lot of time caring and respecting their elders, their ancestors. We should be pushing some of these type of habits to our future AI, you know, prodigies. Right? Versus, I think a lot of Western thoughts is, you know, you put the elderly into a home and you keep them far away so they don't trouble you. We should maybe change that mindset a little bit. So, what I want to emphasize is kind of AI and XR, they're not competing technologies. They are reinforcing technologies that help solve each other's problems. And AI is going to make XR and immersive tech possible. XR is going to be, it will make AI safer, right? And it will make society safer. We, as a society, have a responsibility to do some things, to take action so that we don't end up on that darker side, because it could very easily naturally flow to the darker side. So what do we need to do? AI labs out there, instead of trying to race and trying to get there as fast as possible, we should spend time thinking about safety. Instead of, you know, the metaverse platforms or the, you know, the social network, instead of trying to manipulate people and getting people to spend more time online, we should try to create meaning for the users. If you're a corporate leader, instead of creating greed and profit, probably think about what is really good. What is good for society? What is good for mankind? What is good for your users? If you're a government, instead of thinking, how can I get more power? How can I retain power? How can I use my power? Maybe think about all your constituents. How does this help the people that you are trying to serve? And on an individual basis, rather than thinking about status and wealth, let's think more about substance. How can we make ourselves more well-rounded? How can we make ourselves more knowledgeable, more capable, more productive? At the end of the day, it's really more about thinking short-term versus thinking long-term. Right? The more intelligent, the more knowledgeable you are, the more long-term you are. If you, you know, talk to the sages and the gurus, they're the ones that have read the most and met the most people and seen the most cultures, and they think very long-term. And I think we need to do the same. So here are some of the folks that actually read the book and gave some feedback. People like Neil Stephenson, Ray Kurzweil, Eric Brynjolfsson, who's one of the heads of the Stanford AI Lab, Tom Furness, who godfather of AR, of VR, and then Peter Diamandis, a guy who started the XPRIZE, David Newman, who is the head of Media Lab and a former deputy head of NASA, Jason Heiner, who's the head of or the chief editor for ZDNet, and Scott Stein, editor for CNET. So these are people who know the technology, who know the space, and they all came back and said, this book is worth reading. So I hope you guys will feel the same. So it is available on Amazon and Apple Books ebook as well as audiobook today. The hardcover comes out in June 5th, but the other ones are available already now. So I think we've got just a few minutes for Q&A, and if there's any questions, just come up to the mic and feel free to ask.
Thank you so much. What is the role of spirituality, psychology, and mental health for the creation of this positive future with AI and XR?
I think the AI right now, a lot of it is built on neuroscience, right? So we still don't really understand our own brains, so it's hard to say how much psychology and all these other things will impact how we manage these technologies. But for us as humans, I think we actually need to spend more time doing these softer skills. Ethics and psychology, sociology, philosophy are things that we should spend more time learning so that we can manage each other when these AI systems, go and exceed our cognitive capabilities. Because no matter where it is, we will still need to deal with each other. So rather than having your children focus just purely on STEM and being programmers or mathematicians or engineers, spend more time getting them to learn the softer skills. And I think that will actually serve them much better and give them a lot more long-term longevity in this area. So,
With the Apple headsets and the headset up there, when do you think they'll reach mass adoption, and what will it take?
I think within the next 5 years, we will have gone through 2 to 3 generations. And if you look at what happened with the iPhone, from the original iPhone to the iPhone 3 or 4, it took about 4 or 5 years. And it went from less than 10 million to about 1 billion units. So I think we're probably on that same curve right now. Any other questions? Okay. So I have a few book cards. Anybody who wants one, I can sign one. Because the hardcover is not available for a few months, but if you get the Kindle or the audio, at least you'll have something, a memento, if you're interested. So just come up and feel free to let me know. Thanks.